Tonight, the book of Habakkuk, there are three K's and one B. Probably the toughest book if you ever try to do spelling. When I was a young child in the Christian school, we had to spell, we had to be able to write all the books of the Bible in order, and we had to be able to spell them correctly. And Habakkuk was always the one, and we would be on our way to school, and my mom would be, "Mike, three K's, one B, three K's, one B, three K's, one H-A-B-B-K-K, no, three." Yes, I get it. Let me see if we got this. I got to get my clicker going here. Got it? Okay. Habakkuk chapter 1 and verse 1, the burden which the prophet Habakkuk saw. "O Lord, how long shall I cry and you will not hear? Even cry out to you violence and you will not save. Why do you show me iniquity and cause me to see trouble? For plundering and violence are before me." Have anybody been watching the news recently? Who says the Bible's out of date? "Violence and plundering are before me. There is strife and contention arises. Therefore, the law is powerless. A republic is only given for a moral people. When people become immoral, they must have a dictator." That's the history of the world. Go back to the French Revolution. Go back to the fall of the Roman Republic. When people become immoral, if they cannot rule themselves, then someone else will rule them. The law is powerless. If there is not internal morality, there aren't enough laws to keep us away from strife and violence. Justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous. Therefore, perverse judgment proceeds. Father God, thank you for tonight. Give me the right words to say. Fill me with your spirit. Empty me of myself. Spirit of God, give us insight as we look together into your word, written 2,600 years ago, but as we see in the very first verses, every bit as applicable today as it was when Habakkuk first put pen to writing. Lord, do this work I can't do. Change us to be more in your image. In Jesus' name, amen. To understand the significance as we go through the text tonight, we must understand the context in which Habakkuk writes. Habakkuk is a prophet at the very end of Judah's life. Northern tribe of Israel, the 10 northern tribes, have gone into captivity to Assyria. Think northern Iraq, think Mosul, think eastern Syria. That was the headquarters of the Assyrian, not Syrian, but Assyrian Empire. And in 722, the northern 10 tribes had gone into captivity. Habakkuk is writing 620 BC, 615 BC. He is writing at the very end of Judah's lifespan. He is a contemporary of Jeremiah. He is a contemporary of Ezekiel. He is a contemporary of Daniel, although he would be much older than Daniel. He is writing at the very end when everything is in decay. The northern 10 tribes are gone. They have been scattered to the wind 100 years before. And Habakkuk sees and prophesies when the world is in abject turmoil. What's going on the world stage is this: Assyria is in decline. There are two client states of Assyria. One is Egypt and one is Babylon. Both of those two client states are beginning to gnaw at the carcass of the Assyrian Empire. Babylon has been defeating Assyria slowly but surely. And now, at about the time Habakkuk is going to write, there's going to be a famous battle in 609 at the city called Carchemish. The Egyptians are going to come out of the south and charge through the land of Israel. Josiah, the last godly king of Judah, is aligning himself with Babylon. Why does he align himself with Babylon? He is trying to throw off the Assyrian yoke Egypt is aligning itself with Assyria because it sees itself as the counterweight to Babylon. World politics really doesn't change, just the names change, right? Godly Josiah is 38 years old. He rides north out of Jerusalem to the plain, to the valley of Armageddon. He stations himself at Megiddo. Does this all sound familiar in prophecy? He stations himself at Megiddo, and as the Egyptian pharaoh rides north, he attempts to do a blocking movement in the valley there to stop the Egyptian reinforcements getting to the Assyrians so his ally, the king of Babylon, can wipe out the Assyrians. In that battle, Josiah is killed. The Judean army is put to flight. The Egyptians continue to Carchemish, and the Babylonians wipe out the Assyrians, wipe out the Egyptians, and destroy the Egyptian empire and destroy the Assyrians. But in so doing, the last godly king of Judah dies. The Egyptians, as they retreat from Carchemish, take one of Josiah's kinsmen, who is sympathetic to Egypt, and put him on the throne. This is 609. The Babylonians are irate because they've lost their client state, Judah. It's at this time that Jeremiah is prophesying and Habakkuk is prophesying, and Jeremiah is saying, listen, surrender to the Babylonians. The Babylonians are God's rod against you. You've sinned. Surrender to the... Don't. Egypt is a flax reed. And he would use these terminologies because the reeds in the Nile is what they created papyri or paper from. And he would say it's a flax reed. It just would fall over. Don't align yourself with Egypt. In 605, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, think Chaldea, southern Iraq, appears at the gates of Jerusalem, and he takes captive several important people that you might know, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. He takes the leader's cousins, and he takes them captive as a kind of a thing, if you rebel against me, I'll kill all your nephews, and I'll kill the leadership kids. Well, the foolish Israelites are so, the Judeans are so blind, they continue to rebel. And in 596, the Babylonians come back because the Babylonians put their king on the throne, and then they rebelled, and the Egyptians put a different king on the throne. 596, the Babylonians come back, and it's in this deportation that Ezekiel is taken to the land of Babylon, and 10,000 leaders are taken. Jeremiah stays in Jerusalem, but Ezekiel is now in Babylon. Daniel's in Babylon. Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, they're in Babylon. Finally, there's one last rebellion against the Babylonians. And in 586, Nebuchadnezzar comes back and he utterly wipes them out. By 586, Habakkuk is off the scene, but Habakkuk is seeing this kind of international turmoil. This book is placed in a scene of prophecy about international turmoil, starvation, defeated empire. He sees all this coming as he begins to write this book. As we get into the text tonight, I need you to think through the outline really quickly with me. He is going to complain to God. And you're going to see it tonight. He has two gripes against God. And he is going to complain vociferously, God, you aren't getting it right. Wow. He's going to complain against God that God is not fixing things fast enough on planet Earth. Anybody in the last year had that fleeting thought? You probably it was your wife that had that fleeting thought. God, where are you? Why isn't this getting fixed faster? What's wrong? The second chapter turns out to be God taunting the Babylonians, the Chaldeans. He taunts them. He's going to give them five woes. Woe for this. Woe for that. Woe for this. Woe for that. Woe for this. He's going to give them, because he's proving his dominance. They think the Babylonians, because God's using them as a rod of his wrath against the Jews, they are now thinking they are the boss. And God saying to them, I got news for you. I'm still in control. You are just a rod. I'm in control. It's a great thing for us to remember that when nations go through God's chastening, whatever tool God uses, it's just his rod. They're not in control. He's still totally in control. Then we're going to get to chapter 3, and God is going to turn Habakkuk's mind from why God to who is like you. He's going to turn Habakkuk from these, you owe me an answer, to, wow, God. So let's dive into the text. Joy in times of calamity. So you're going to have to follow with me because I'm going to kind of take it out of order so you can look at the two gripes and God's answer to the gripes. Okay, so here's the gripes. Don't you care about my hurt as I look at those hurting around me? God, don't you care? And he says this, we saw this, the burden of prophet Habakkuk. He saw the Lord, I cry, you will not hear. Even cry out to you, there's violence, and you're not doing anything, you're not saving. Why do you show me iniquity? Why do I have to look at such sin? Do you ever get nauseous when you watch television at the sin that's portrayed on television? Do you get nauseous, or do you just like jump in and enjoy it? Habakkuk was nauseous at the sin that he saw all around him. Why? There's plundering. There's violence. It's the story of America today. There's strife. There's contention. The law is doing nothing. Justice isn't happening. The wicked are all around us. God, what are you doing? That's his first gripe. Then his second gripe is this. So in the text, we'll get back to how God answers that gripe. So remember the gripe. But I want to skip forward to Habakkuk's second gripe. Okay, so I'm taking them out of order. We're going to skip forward. Are you following how I'm doing this? It's easier to take the two gripes in one set and then combine them and answer them than it is to go back and forth. So his second gripe is this. God, you're powerful and pure. You're powerful and pure. So why do you allow evil? Wow. Is that not the historic philosophical question of all time? God, why do you allow evil? You are all powerful. You are completely pure. Why do you allow evil? So skip down to verse 12. He says, are you not from everlasting? You're the self-existing one. Oh Lord, my God, my Holy One, we shall not die. Oh Lord, you've appointed them for judgment. Speaking of the Babylonians. Speaking of the Chaldeans. You have marked them for correction. You are of pure eyes than to behold evil and cannot look on wickedness. Why do you look on those who deal treacherously? In other words, why do you just look at them? Why don't you do something about this? And hold your tongue when the wicked devours. How can you not say something, God? A person more righteous than he, why do you make men like fish of the sea? Listen to his analogy. Like creeping things that have no ruler over them. So that they're lawless. They have no ruler. They go wherever they want to go. And they take up all of them with a hook. They catch them in their net and gather them in their dragnet. And then you notice what he says. And then they rejoice and are glad. And then they sacrifice to their net. In other words, they make their own net. And then they worship their net as God. They burn incense to their dragnet. They worship their own creation. They worship their own mind. They think they're so smart. They think they're you've made them without leaders, and they do whatever they want, and then they think that they turn around and worship something they created. Of course, in those days, it was an actual idol, right? But in America, we worship the works of our hands all the time. We think that we're so much smarter than all the generations that went before us. And yet, in the first four verses of a book written 2,600 years ago, it could have been written on the front page of the New York Times today. We think we're so much smarter. We're not. Man doesn't change. His inherently evil nature will never change. Man wants to dominate other men. Man wants to boss other men. Man wants to control other men. Man wants to brutalize other men. This is the nature of man. And it's why our founders were so wise in creating disparate places, legislative, executive, judicial, because they would balance the evil natures of the men in those positions, would balance each other off as they fought for dominance. Our whole longest history running republic is based upon the theology of the depravity of man. That was the a priori, that was the assumed idea behind our Constitution, was man is evil and he must have law to offset the evilness. Why are you so powerful? Why don't you just do away with evil? Why aren't you fixing things? But I want you to notice number two in your, even though he's got these gripes, and I'm going to just be honest with you, there are times in my life I have gripes against God that are of a similar nature. Why aren't you fixing this? This family is in distress, God. Why aren't you fixing this? They won't listen to you, God. Why aren't you fixing this? Why are you letting this person hurt that person? God, why aren't you fixing this? God, why did you let that child die? Why did you let her daddy do that to her? There have been many times in my ministry life where I've said similar things to God. God, I don't understand. I don't understand with who you are and what I know you to be. Why is this happening? And I want you to notice, in the middle of Habakkuk's frustration, this is such a key verse for all of us. When we get to that point of frustration, God, it's not fair. That other person got the bigger paycheck and I deserved it. The other person got more favorable status and I deserved it. And they stole my... It's not fair. Look at what verse 1 says. He says, I will stand my watch. Habakkuk's watch was to prophesy to Israel and not stop. No matter what they said. No matter how they didn't like him. He said, I will stand my watch and set myself on the rampart. The rampart is where they would look to see the enemy coming at night. And they would stand on the wall and look out. And he said, and I will watch to see what he will say to me and what I will answer when I am corrected. In other words, this is like a 2-year-old who knows he's in trouble for stealing a cookie. I know the correction is coming. I don't know what I'm going to say because I know what I'm saying and what I'm writing down. I know this isn't what's right, but God, I'm just going to tell you, this is how I feel right now. I want you to notice the prophet's unshakable faith. He's not saying, I'm out of here. And I was rehearsing with Ken today and a couple of you others over the last couple days. Some of my best friends that grew up, Mark Roberts and I were talking about some of our best friends that grew up with us, and now that we're all in our 50s, and we grew up in the same youth group. And some have gone into complete heresy. I mean, just unbelievable, wicked, vile heresy. And then you have men like myself, or Kevin Shaw, or Larry Carlisle,
or Mark and my wife, we were all in the same youth group of 100 kids. And it's like you have pastors and missionaries and ministers' wives and deacons' wives in that group of 100 kids. And you have men that were so perverted that God took their life early because they were trying to destroy the Christian faith, actively working to destroy the Christian faith. And it's just amazing for us in our 50s to look at how did that, where did they, same teachers, same youth pastor, same Christian school, same revival meeting, same Bible verses, same everything. And one chose yes, and one said, not what Habakkuk said, I will stand my watch. I got frustrated at something, and so I'm throwing it all out. In the middle of Habakkuk not understanding, in the middle of him being frustrated, he said, but I'm not going anywhere, God. I'm going to stand here and let you correct me. That's powerful faith. That's powerful faith. But let's look at God's two answers. First of all, to the first question. The first question was, don't you care about my hurt as I look at those hurting around me? So here's his answer to that. He says, if I'm intimately involved in the rise and fall of nations, then I'm fully engaged in your difficulties. Now that's a long answer, and you think, is that really? Is what are you, like, it's like, God, you're not really answering Habakkuk's gripe. He's actually answering it way better than Habakkuk could have ever hoped. If I'm powerful enough to raise up the Chaldees, squash the Assyrians, throw off the Egyptians, then don't you think I know when there are problems going on in Judah? So you can read what he says in verse 5. He says, look among the nations and watch. So he's gonna take him out of Jerusalem and he says, look at the big scene. Look at the nations and watch. Be utterly astounded. For I will work a work in your days which you would not believe though it were told you. For indeed I am raising up the Chaldeans, a bitter and hasty nation which marches through the breadth of the earth to possess dwelling places that are not theirs. They are terrible and dreadful. Their judgment and their dignity proceed from themselves. Their horses also are swifter than leopards and more fierce than evening wolves. Their chargers charge ahead. Their cavalry comes from afar. They fly as the eagle that hastens to eat. They all come for violence. Their faces are set like the east wind. They gather captives like sand. They scoff at kings, and princes are scorned by them. They deride every stronghold, for they heap up earthen mounds and seize it. Then his mind changes and he transgresses. He commits offense, ascribing this power to his God. I mean, he describes the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, to a T, and what they're going to do to the ancient Near East. And he closes by saying, and I know that they will think it's their God that has done this. It's really me. They will think it's their God, but it's really me. Habakkuk, I got this. Don't worry. If I can raise up the Chaldeans, I can see the violence and the lawlessness that's going on. Let me tell you something. Where we can rest as we look at violence and lawlessness and rioting and looting and all the things that are going on in our country, and the back and forth of political parties, let me tell you something. There is a thrice holy God in heaven that speaks through the prophet Habakkuk today, and he says, I got this. I got it. God's not chain smoking in heaven because the earth is out of control. He hasn't nibbled all of his fingernails off because he's so anxious over what the future may hold for planet Earth. I got this. He tells Habakkuk, if I'm intimately involved in raising up this power and I know that they will mock me, don't worry about it. I'll take care of them later, which is going to be chapter 2. But notice what he says next. Let me skip through the verses. So then the second gripe that Habakkuk had, which is very common, if you are so powerful and pure, why don't you do away with evil? And you know what God's answer to that one is? If you're so powerful, why don't you do away with evil? God's answer is, you need to learn to live by faith. Wow.
You know, I look at those two answers and I go, wow, God, those seem a little bit incomplete. I'm not sure Habakkuk was like, woo-woo, woo-woo, I got the answer I wanted, I got the answer I wanted. I'm not sure that was Habakkuk's response. Really, God, the answer is I need to live more by faith? But isn't that the right answer? Let's look at the text. Chapter 2 and verse 1, he says, I will stand the watch. Okay, now look at verse 2. Then the Lord answered me and said, write the vision. Okay, I'm going to give you a job. You've come at me with your gripes. Now I'm going to give you a job to do. You're sitting around moping and complaining. Now you need to get to work. And he told Habakkuk, you're not allowed to telework. You have to go out in the community. So that's in the Hebrew. Some of you didn't see that there, but Habakkuk was not allowed to telework. Okay, so anyway. Then the Lord answered, and this is from someone who's been teleworking for 5 months. Write the vision. Make it plain on tablets, that he may run who reads it. For the vision is yet for an appointed time. He's like, I got it. What's going to happen is in the future, but it's going to happen. I got this. It's for an appointed time. But at the end it will speak and it will not lie. Though it tarries, wait for it. Because it will surely come. It will not tarry. Let me tell you something. Revelation says, and I saw a new heaven and a new earth. And from him that sat on it, everything fled away. And he came down from heaven as a bride for a bridegroom. Let me tell you something. God's got this. It may tarry in our mind. God's got this. And he says then, behold the proud. His soul is not upright in him, but the just shall live by faith. The author of the book of Hebrews takes this verse and quotes it in Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 38 as he's driving home the point to Jewish Christians, most likely after the death of Paul, who are being persecuted by their kinsmen, and he takes them back to this text in Habakkuk and says, listen, the promise is still coming. The context is, I got this. God's got it. Jewish Christian in the first century in Hebrews, I got this. We still live by faith. And the message of Habakkuk and the message of Hebrews is still applicable to us today. The just still live by faith. We're saved by faith. We die in faith. And we live by faith. He says to him, you need to learn to live by faith. And notice number 4, and I know I have to hurry. I think Awana gets out at, what, 8:30, 9 o'clock, something like that? So I want to clue you in on something. So Ken found out I was coming out for the Labor Day weekend, and he was so kind. And Dr. Endine said, would you like to open up? He said, it's the first service of us getting back together on Sunday nights. And I was like, oh, that would be wonderful. And he said, he offered me some money. And he said to me, he said, Mike, now, he said, I want to look really good for our people. I said, okay, I'll try to do a good job. And no, he said, misunderstand. He said, if you'll preach for an hour and 45 minutes, so that next week when I preach for 35 minutes, I'll look really good, I'll pay you off. So I'm just saying, right now, I'm at about the 30-minute mark. If anybody out there wants to up what he already paid me, I can finish sooner. I'm open to be bribed, okay? I'm open. I've lived in Washington for 16 months. I'm open to be bribed, okay? I'm just saying. Only my cousin can get away doing that. That's it. I'm surprised my dad wasn't walking down the aisle too, so. Yeah, too far to walk. So let's look at, now that God has told him, he's answered his dilemmas, now we're going to move to that second chapter where God is going to issue these 5 woes. Only the person in charge can mock. Only the person in charge can pronounce woes on another person. And God's going to give them five woes found in verse 6, verse 9, verse 12, verse 15, and verse 19. And he's aiming them at the Chaldeans. Now bear in mind, it's about the time of the Battle of Carchemish. The Babylonians haven't even come to Jerusalem yet. That won't happen till 605. This is at least 4, 5, 6 years still in the future before the Babylonians will even come for the first deportation, let alone the second deportation, let alone the destruction of Jerusalem in 586. So this is years in the future. God is already predicting the fall and the destruction of the Babylonians before they even become a worldwide dominant empire. I got this, God says to Habakkuk. So let's say what God says to them. He says the God's prophet is now going to mock them in their attempts to satisfy themselves. And if you don't think that these woes apply to America, you look at them. You look at the five woes. He says, indeed, because he transgresses by wine, he is a proud man, and he does not stay at home, because he enlarges, his desire is hell, and he is like death, and he cannot be satisfied. He gathers to himself all nations and heaps for himself all peoples. Wow. He says, indeed, because he transgresses by wine, he is a proud man. Then in verse 6, he says, will not all these take up a proverb against him and taunting riddle against him and say, woe to him who increases. Wow, are we a nation that increases? We will just go into debt to just increase stuff. Woe to him that increases what is not his. How long? In other words, he increases by borrowing. He increases by stealing. He increases by greed. He increases by manipulation. He increases by every which way. And he says to him, your time of reaping is going to come. I don't know if I gave you the last one. Your alcohol-induced greed will destroy you. Did you see that if you're taking notes? So he says, your greed will destroy you. Your time of reaping is going to come. That's this next section. He says, will not your creditors rise up suddenly? Will they not awaken who oppress you? And you will become their booty. In other words, what he's saying is, he's using a metaphor of going into debt to what the Chaldeans are going to do as they rob and pillage and destroy nations. They are increasing the creditors, the people that hate them, the people that will want to pay them back, the people that will want to destroy them. They're increasing, and he's using a metaphor of how we go into debt to say, you're sowing evil, you're going to get people back that hate you. He says, will not your creditors rise up? You will become their booty because you have plundered many nations. All the remnant of the people shall plunder you because of men's blood and the violence of the land and the city and all who dwell in it. Woe to him who covets evil gain for his house. Is that not America? Is that not coveting evil gain, ripping off the nation? I joked about the bribing, but we get it, right? The under-the-table deals, whether it's in Washington or Phoenix or Denver or any capital or any small town, or woe to him who does dishonesty for his house because he thinks he can set his nest on high, like the bird at a cliff line, that he may be delivered from the power of disaster. You give shameful counsel to your house, cutting off many peoples, and sin against your soul. You understand all these woes? Our country, by doing all these woes, is actually sinning against its own soul. Let me give you a quick illustration. So there is a young woman who's a senior enlisted
who is in our building, and we have 1,200 people that work in our building, and she and I have gotten to know each other a little bit because of me doing work around the building, and she's working on a doctorate in counseling and preventive self-harm, and a whole bunch of other issues. So she called me up and said, "Chaplain Sproul, I'd really like to interview you on my doctoral thesis." And I said, "That's great. What are you writing on?" She goes, I'm writing on suicide in the Air National Guard." I go, "Wow, wow, that's a lot of brilliant minds have spent a lot of time thinking about that one, and we spent a lot of money on it, as Pastor Nathan knows because he's involved in that. I mean, we spend a lot of money on that topic, and our suicide rates continue to go up. So we set up a time, and she called me back, and she said, "So I've talked to mental health, I've talked to equal opportunity, I've talked to people that have that have had loved ones that have taken their lives." You know, she said, I'm toward the end of doing my research, and she is, by the way, a Christian. And so she said to me, "What is, in your estimation, the number one cause of suicide?" And I said, "Okay, so I want to be both truthful and politically correct at this point." I said, "And this is true. There are a lot of brilliant people that have spent a lot of time looking at this issue. And it's not just in our era. It goes all the way back. It goes back to ancient days. You read about ancient Greek warriors taking their lives because of the emotional harm they went through in seeing their friends die in battle. That's well known." I said, "But can I tell you what I see?" And she said, "Yeah." I said, "I know I'm going to give you an answer that no one else is going to give you." She said, "Okay." I said, "People take their life because generally they are so lonely and they have no way of expiating their sin." And she's like, "Okay, I'm going to write that down. What is expiate and how do you spell it?" I said, "Expiate means to forgive, to have it taken away." And I said, "What you're going to hear from mental health and psychologists is that's a relic of the past, that guilt that's brought on by religion. And we need to expiate guilt, except God created us." I said, "Do you believe in Adam and Eve?" And she said, "Well, yeah." I said, "What was the first thing Adam and Eve did? Nobody told them they were naked. They covered themselves. They immediately cut the relationship between themselves and God by sewing an apron of fig leaves. They became lonely. And ever since the first sin, man is lonely. Humans are lonely. And what creates isolation and loneliness is sin. Sin always isolates. We may do sin in a group and ha, 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 laugh, laugh. But when we get back on our bed by ourselves, we're still left with our conscience, and it is a lonely place when a man's conscience. So what do? We hammer our conscience, and then we become sociopathic. Think Stalin. Think Lenin. Think Mao Zedong. Think Hitler. Because the only way we can deal with a guilty conscience is to just continuously knock it down, and then God, Romans 1, turns them over to a reprobate mind because they would not acknowledge the truth. We had a very fascinating hour and a half conversation. And I said, even in faith traditions that I would disagree with, there is a method of expiating or a process to get forgiveness. I said, what the secular world cannot offer, what mental health, I said, so our opioid addiction is up 4 times in the last 20 years. Our alcoholism in the last 20 years has gone through the roof, and it's happening in suburban gated communities with white women who are having 4 and 5 glasses of wine a day. It's called mommy juice to make it through the day. And I said, we are lonely and we can't expiate sin. We have no vehicle for getting rid of the guilt. Now I said, is that every single suicide? Absolutely not. But I said, you're asking me for generalities, and I'm giving you generalities. I said, and as a Christian, I said, the great news that I have, remember when I started off and said the need of our nation is Jesus? We have the answer. 1 John 1:9, if we confess our sin, he's faithful and just to forgive us our sin and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. Being justified by faith, we have access to God through Jesus Christ. See, we as believers, this is where we should live. We have the message to solve the problems of our nation. We do. Paul wrote to a completely ethnically divided nation, the Roman Empire. The Jews hated the Greeks. The Romans hated the Greeks. The Greeks hated the Jews. I mean, the barbarians wanted to overthrow Rome. And Paul writes to that church in Galatia, and he says, there is neither Jew nor Greek, bond, slave, or free, but one new man in Christ. When 50% of the world was a slave, and about 300 Roman families ruled the entire Mediterranean world, from the Scottish border in the north to Sudan in the south to modern-day Iraq in the east to Spain in the west to Germany in the north, and 300 families ruled that empire with an iron fist, crucifying and slaughtering. In days of battle, 75,000 enemy soldiers would die in hand-to-hand combat in a single day. When Caesar took over Gaul 40 years before Christ was born, there were battles in which 75,000 Gauls died in a single day, in swords, hand-to-hand. How bloody, how gruesome. And yet this idea, there is one new man in Christ, rockets onto the New Testament world. What? There's no bond or free? We're all equal in the sight of God? There is no rich or poor? That Caesar in his golden palace, Nero, in his golden palace in Rome, that was 400 acres, where he would light the Christians on fire, that he's equal before God? Yes. When Nero commits suicide at the age of 30 after decimating the Christian church, he stood before God the same way Paul and Peter that he had condemned to death. The ground was equal. What an idea that we have to share with the world, that straight Bible, the way of expiating sin. Now, I took too long on my illustration, but it's those kind of things that I wish I could scream in my current position, right? It breaks your heart, because you know you have, when you hear of the suicides in your wings, and every single suicide or attempted suicide in the Air National Guard, I get a notification on it. It comes across my phone. I get a text. Every single one. And we live in a hopeless nation. People are without hope. They truly, truly are. Let me move on. He says, your time of reaping will come. Let me skip through that very quickly, because I read all those verses already. He says, your worship of your own handiwork will cause you emptiness. Oh, this is America. Why is America so angry? We are the richest nation to ever exist. We have more stuff. We have more ease. I just finished a book that I bought for my wife. It's entitled Marriage to a Disagreeable Man. And I think I messed up the title. A Difficult Man. Yes, Marriage to a Difficult Man. Thank you, sweetheart. She said she wrote it, so that's why I read it. She said, this is my autobiography. I want you to proof it. So it's the story of Sarah Edwards. Have any of you ever heard of the book? Every woman should read it. Sarah Edwards, do you know who her husband was? Jonathan Edwards. Probably the greatest theologian, greatest pastor theologian that America has ever produced. Just an amazing man. And what she went through, she bore 11 children. And in her day, the average life expectancy was 33. And she bore Jonathan Edwards 11 children. And the most amazing, 100 years later, they had a gathering of all of the grandkids and great-grandkids. And it, Vice President of the United States, U.S. Senators, college presidents, seminary presidents. The only knock on Sarah and Jonathan's, all their progeny, was one guy by the name of Aaron Burr. Aaron Burr was the grandson of Jonathan and Sarah Edwards. And his mother was Esther, and his father was Aaron Burr. And Esther dies when little Aaron Burr is about 4, and his dad dies when he's 3, and he's left to his 20-year-old uncle, and he becomes a dissolute and a very evil and vile man. But other than that, Sarah Edwards has this just this amazing, it's just, she's just an amazing woman. And I encourage you, if you can find it on Amazon, I strongly encourage you to find it. And when I was reading this, how simple they lived their life. I mean, they made their own candles. She made her kids' own clothes. I mean, it's just unbelievably remarkable, all the things that she did. And I look at us today, and I'm like, and we gripe and grouse and complain and are not happy and are miserable. And if somebody cuts us off in the freeway, we're like, dude, you got a car, you didn't walk. You should be, yes, I have a car, somebody cut me off. Yeah, I have a car. He says to them, you're going to be miserable because you worship the work of your hand. Look at verse 18. He says, what profit is the image that its maker should carve it? The molded image, a teacher of lies, that the maker of its mold should trust in it to make mute idols. He says, woe to him who says to wood, awake. In other words, the fifth woe is you think the stuff you make will make you happy. You think the stuff that you have will make you content. It won't. It won't. Woe to that false idea. Arise, it shall teach. Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, yet in it there is no breath at all. And then we're almost done, and I want you to stay with me because the most powerful verses, maybe in all the Old Testament, are coming here really quickly. As I've kind of taken you to the culture and the context so that you're going to get what immense faith Habakkuk has. God is now going to take him from, why aren't you doing something, God, to God saying, I'm going to control the Chaldeans so much that I can pronounce woes on them. And now he's going to turn Habakkuk to his character. And he's going to say, it's all about me. It's not all about you. The prophet's vision is cleared by who owns the world. I love this verse. When my mom taught children's church, and I grew up listening to children's church, every Sunday morning we said this verse together. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. Remember, the context is, God, there's so much bad stuff. Why aren't you fixing it? If you're so holy and so pure, why aren't you fixing it? And then he gets him to chapter 2 and verse 20, and he says, Habakkuk, I'm in my temple. I got this. I'm in control. It may not be on your timeline, but I got this. Be quiet. Be quiet. The Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the rioting, let all the looting, let all the murder, let all the evil plotting, let it just be quiet. God is at work, so be still. But notice number two or B, This is an amazing recitation. I'm going to go through it very quickly. But God reminds Habakkuk of his merciful revival of an enslaved people. Now bear in mind, this is happening. This text is being written about 620, 610 BC. The children of Israel came out of Egypt in about 1445 BC. So he is now going to take Habakkuk back 800 years. So stop and think. The Plymouth plantation, it's this fall, right? November, when the pilgrims came 400 years ago. And we think, oh, that's a long way. He's about to take him back times two. He's about to take Habakkuk back 800 years. So he writes this amazing, amazing song. He says, God, Habakkuk then says, "O Lord, I have heard your speech and was afraid. I've heard your woes. I've heard your control. I've heard what you're going to do. And I was afraid. Lord, revive your work in the midst of the years. In the midst of the years, make known in wrath. Look at Israel. Remember mercy, God. I get it. You're in control of the Chaldeans. You're in control of the Assyrians. You're in control of the Egyptians. Oh, God, remember mercy on us in the middle of our sin. Judah, remember us." Wow. What a wonderful, wonderful way to begin this history lesson. Because God's sovereign deliverance and care for Israel is going to prove to Habakkuk that the timing and method of his work is up to God. Because he's been working for 800 years. Now let's look in. He says this. He says, God came from Teman, the Holy One from Mount Paran. Okay, you got to get your geography. Where is Teman and where is Paran? The Sinai. Edom. It's to the south. Babylon is going to attack from the north. So he's taking him back as an illustration of how the children of Israel wandered in the wilderness, wandered in Sinai. He's taking him back 800 years. He says, God came out of the south. Yes, the Babylonians are going to come out of the north, but we came out of the south. And he said, his glories covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise. His brightness was like the light. He had rays flashing from his hand, and there his power was hidden. Before him went pestilence, and fever followed. Think the ten plagues. Pestilence went before him. Fever followed at his feet. He stood and measured the earth and looked and startled the nations, and the everlasting mountains were scattered. The perpetual hills bowed. His ways are everlasting. I saw in the tents of Cushan affliction. The curtains of the land of Midian trembled. Those are kingdoms again to the south. O Lord, were you displeased with the rivers? Think the Red Sea. Think the Jordan River as they came into the land. He's going to use these as analogies. He says, were you displeased with the rivers? Was your anger against the rivers? Was your wrath against the sea that you rode on your horses, your chariots of salvation? Do you remember the song of the women after they crossed the Red Sea and they talked about the chariots were gone and God's salvation? He's taking him back to that song of Miriam in this analogy. He says, your bow was made quite ready. Oaths were sworn over your arrows. You divided the earth with rivers. The mountains saw you and trembled. The overflowing of water passed by. The deep uttered its voice and lifted its hand on high. Think of the Red Sea collapsing on the Egyptian army. The sun and moon stood still in their habitation. Oh, think of Joshua when the sun stood still. He's reminding them. At the light of your arrows they went. At the shining of your glittering spear, you marched through the land in indignation. You trampled the nations in anger. You went forth for the salvation of your people, for salvation with your anointed. You struck the head from the house of the wicked by laying bare the foundation to the neck. You thrust through with his own arrows the head of his villages. They came out like a whirlwind to scatter me. The rejoicing was like feasting on the poor in secret. You walked through the sea with your horses. Again, think Red Sea. Through the heap of great waters. He's recounting all 800 years in allusions of how God has taken care of Israel. Then he gets to verse 16. Let me skip through all the verses really quick because I read them out of my Bible instead of clicking through them. And this is the point of the entire book. The prophet's response has gone from, "What's wrong with you, God?" to not only physical weakness, but a beautiful spiritual hymn of faithful praise. When I heard, verse 16, my body trembled. My lips quivered at the voice. I mean, Habakkuk has just seen God. And he realizes this God who's been faithful to us for 800 years rightfully should chasten us. And he has just revealed himself to me and his plan for the ages. And he trembles. My lips quivered at the voice. Rottenness entered my bones. In other words, he sees God and he is now, remember at the beginning, he was like, there's violence around me and there's wickedness and there's bad people and why aren't you doing something? And all of a sudden Habakkuk goes, I'm rotten. I'm seeing God. You know, sometimes we as Christians can sit back and go, well, and we get so consumed with everybody else's sin that we forget how rotten we are. And when Habakkuk realizes that, his everything changes. He says, I trembled in myself that I might rest in the day of trouble. Do you understand that when you understand how great our God is and how he controls, you can rest in the day of trouble? I mean, he was about to go through it. The trouble hadn't even started yet. The Babylonians haven't even appeared on the scene. Bad stuff is really going to happen over the next 35 years to Jerusalem. Really bad stuff. They are going to go from millions down to a few thousand. They are going to be obliterated by the Babylonians because of their sin. And he says, when he comes up to the people, he will invade him with his troops. But this is so wonderful. He gets that all of this is going to take place. He sees God's controlling hand in the past causes great peace in the disquiet of the present. He sees that God's controlling hand in the past causes great peace in the disquiet of the present. He believes, and this gets to his hymn, he believes that the economy may crumble to the point of starvation, because this is what's so beautiful. His faith is so renewed. He says, though the fig tree may not blossom, understand that figs were a major exporter. It was a major part of their economy. So that's like saying Wall Street doesn't open tomorrow. No, nothing happens on the stock exchange tomorrow because the economy collapses tomorrow. The fig tree may not blossom. There's no fruit on the vine. One of their great exports was also wine. Though the labor of olive may fail, they had three major exports, and olive oil was their major export. The other two, so he's going at the heart of their economy. Their three biggest parts of their economy get blown up. He says, though the fig tree may not blossom, no fruit on the vines, labor of the olive may fail, and the fields yield no food. He's picturing utter economic devastation and absolute famine, the whole nation literally starving to death. And then he says, and the flock may be cut off from the fold. In other words, all the sheep die. All the cows die. And there's no herd in the stalls. Understanding the sovereign master gives the inner faith for a believer's rest. Understanding that the sovereign master gives inner faith for the believer's rest. He says, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. One of the most powerful verses in all of Scripture, especially when understood in its context. The economy's collapsed. The Babylonians are conquering us. Our people are being enslaved. Everything is a disaster. I'm going to rejoice. I'm going to joy in God. It doesn't look like it's salvation. This is the opposite of salvation. And yet he calls him the God of salvation. And then he realizes the master gives us quiet confidence that he is in control, so that he makes us jump over difficulties like a deer on a ledge. How many of you have been to En-Gedi with me? How many have been to En-Gedi with me? So Ken and I are going to go back, late May, early June of 22. And our plan is to go to Rome and then Israel. And if anybody wants to go, we'll go down to Egypt on the way coming back. So that's kind of our plan. So put that in your hopper. Late May, early June of 22, we'll go for probably 12, 13 days, something like that, before it gets too terribly hot. But one of the places we'll go is En-Gedi. If you've been to En-Gedi, how many of you remember those little deer we saw? Do you remember the little deer up on the ledge, hopping, and they hop from ledge to ledge, and there's just like inches for them to hop, and they fall, they would die? And that's the picture Habakkuk has. He says, God is my strength, not the Judean army, not the Egyptian army, not the Babylonian. God is my strength, and he will make me as sure-footed as a little deer on a cliff line. He will make me that sure-footed, and he will make me hop on the highest hills. He will make me walk on my high hills. What's interesting to notice, Dave, you'll like this, is that he starts off a frustrated believer. He has some demands of God. God answers him in a way that we would not think of answering, like, have more faith. I've taken care of you for a long time. I got this. I mean, that's not how we would normally. You mean, oh, sure, you have some problems. Tell me your problems. Oh, sure. God just says, the just live by faith, buddy. That's what this is. And he reminds him of his providential, and he goes from a gripey, discontented believer to a composer of one of the richest hymns we have in Scripture. Because you know the process? Of when I'm walking with God, I naturally want to sing his praises. And Habakkuk ends, and if you notice at the end of the book, if you have it in your Bible, it says, to the chief musician with my stringed instrument. He writes a hymn saying, everything can collapse, but you're going to make me as sure-footed as a little deer, because you're the God of my salvation.